Welcome, Eagles, to another episode of Trad Cat Night Radio. I am Eric Ajewski, founder and owner of Trad Cat Night, most viewed and followed traditional Catholic website worldwide. Ladies and gentlemen, I have another special guest with me here today. We're going to be getting into a lot of different subjects, unmasking some of the corruption in the Catholic Church. A man who's certainly well known for his previous work, but now is working for the Lepanto Institute. I have with me Mr. Michael Hitchborn. And so he's a well-known public figure within the pro-life movement. He spent 7.5 years as American Life League's director of Defend the Faith Project. In this capacity, Michael has researched and produced an annual report on organizations receiving grant money from the Catholic Campaign for Human Development. Now, to move along a little bit, and feel free, Michael, as we're moving along, to tap into any of your previous experiences. Specifically, we want to promote the Lepanto Institute and get into that. But, you know, Michael holds a Bachelor's of Arts degree from Christendom College on Political Science and Economics, a Master's degree in Education from American Intercontinental University. He is down there in Virginia with his wife, Alyssa, and their 6 children. If I'm not mistaken, I think you told me you got another one on the way, correct, too?
Yes, that is our 6th.
Okay, that will be the 6th. Okay. So, great. Well, Michael, thank you for joining Trad Cat Night Radio. Again, a lot going on in the world, specifically within the church. We can get into this a little bit, but there was another bishop that came out yesterday. LifeSite News was reporting that, you know, now re-echoing what Francis has been saying, that we need to apologize to the sodomites and along that line. Hopefully we'll get into the whole sodomite agenda later. So first and foremost, my question for you, Michael, as you kind of transitioned from your previous work into the Lepanto Institute, maybe you can tell our listeners what it's all about, you know, what the mission statement is. I read it briefly this morning, and it's similar to what we're trying to do here at Trad Cat Night.
Well, basically, we all know that there is a major spiritual war taking place in the world right now. The Catholic Church is under assault from the forces of darkness, whether it's in the government or whether it's in the culture. It's in the law. But we're also facing a struggle within. We've got a lot of individuals and agencies that are trying to undermine the teachings of the Catholic faith. They are trying to ruin the faith of faithful Catholics. And quite frankly, they are lying about what the Gospels are teaching with regard to what it is that we're supposed to be doing with our lives. All we ever hear now from many pulpits is social justice, right, when really what we should be talking about is God's justice, but you don't hear about that. So at the Lepanto Institute, it was really kind of born out of my research into the CCHD, my research into Catholic Relief Services, and I started to notice a trend. I saw what was taking place through the Catholics' agencies in order to pervert the teachings of the Church, and so that's why I got into the Lepanto Institute. Of course, it was done through a lot of prayer, and there's a whole other story with regard to that, too. It's very clear that Our Lady set me on this path, that she wants me to do this kind of work. But there it is.
Yeah, I was just about to ask you about that. I mean, I know before I jumped into Trad Cat Night, having started Defeat Modernism, so one thing I did is, I prayed for direction. And obviously, you're very devoted to Our Lady and the Rosary, too. Talk about, you know, that connection and how she's guided you along, not only your work, but your family. And just, you know, the impact she's made on your life, but then also going forward, I always said this, you know, we're entering into our time period as a lot of these more unsettling events are occurring. You know, we have more reassurance by going to the Blessed Virgin Mary and hiding under her mantle, if you will, from God's justice to be protected from a lot of these, unsettling events to come. But to talk a little bit more about, your relationship with the Blessed Virgin Mary.
Sure. Well, you know, I decided years ago, I mean, this is back when I was in high school, that I would start saying a daily rosary, and it really just kind of started with praying my rosary on my way into work, you know. I'd pull out the rosary, and I'd just pray on my way into work, and now I was done with it. I didn't necessarily live a very forthright and moral life, but I did commit to the rosary, and I did continue to say my rosary. And it was through the rosary, actually, that I wound up at Christendom College, which is strange because I was a high school dropout. I hated school. I swore I'd never go to college, but I maintained the rosary. And through a friend of mine, I wound up at Christendom, and it was like falling in love for the first time at first sight. I stepped foot on campus and I felt awash, like, this is where I belong. This is home. And that's what I did. I went to Christendom. I spent 5 years at Christendom. In fact, in my fifth year, I met my wife. And it was through the rosary that my wife and I were able to discern that, yes, we were meant for each other. So we got married. Now we've got six lovely children. And, you know, as I continued to work, the daily rosary was just a continuous part of my life. And I realized, as I look back, you know, every single time I had a major decision in my life or there was a major turning point, I would turn to the rosary and just say, Mother, I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing here, but I really need you to help me. And I know that she knows where I'm supposed to be, so why should I rely on myself?
Right.
And it really took a load off, you know? So I would just, at every major junction, just ask Our Lady, what is it I'm supposed to be doing? You know where I should be, so please tell me what I should do. And she always did. And through that, I wound up opening two Catholic high schools in the Fredericksburg area, one of which is still going strong. From there, I went to work for almost 8 years at American Life League. And in the last few months that I worked at American Life League, and this is where it becomes quite clear to me what I should be doing. I was on a trip. I was visiting with bishops, trying to explain to them the things that I'd been discovering. And while I was out visiting with bishops, I had a video report that was supposed to be released. And it got held, and it continued to be held, and I was wondering what was going on. So when I get back to the office, I'm told, look, we just had a board meeting. We are going to have to make some budget cuts. They're cutting your project. They're not firing you. We'd like to shift you into some other work, but you're not to do these investigations anymore. And at the time, I had a major investigation into Catholic Relief Services that I was getting ready to release. I was really stuck. They said, look, the alternative is that we could pay you a severance and you could try and start your own thing. Now, immediately my thought was, well, there goes my investigations. I guess I just got to roll along to play along. And I went to my office and I called my wife and I talked to her on the phone. And she absolutely shocked me, because my wife is the kind of person that is all about the sure deal. Make sure you've got that steady income. You know, we're not here to roll the dice with our finances, sure. You know? So I told her what was going on, and the first words out of her mouth absolutely blew me away. She said, well, it seems like it's time for you to move on then.
Wow.
And I was like, whoa. So they gave me 3 days to make a decision. And so I went home. My wife and I talked and prayed about this for 3 days solid. I don't think there was a moment of our day that we weren't talking about what I was going to do. So the morning I was supposed to make my decision, I was still undecided. I was still conflicted. And I was on my way into work. I was praying my rosary, and I just stopped. I stopped and I said, Mother, I don't know what I'm supposed to do here. I don't know what my call is. It seems like I should stay, but it seems like maybe you're calling me in another direction. I really need you to tell me.
Yeah.
And I got this inspiration. Call your spiritual director and do whatever he says. Said, fine. That's exactly what I'll do. Takes the responsibility out of my hands. So I'll just go along with that. So I did. I got to work. First thing I did, I called my spiritual director and I told him what's going on. And the first words out of his mouth were, Michael, I know you, I know your wife, I know your situation, and I think Our Lady is saying that you need to move on into this new direction. And I was shocked again. So I went right into my boss's office, and we had a conversation, and I told him that I was leaving. He shook my hand and congratulated me, and at the end of the month, I left. Well, that night after I quit, my wife and I were up talking about it, and it's one of those situations where you've got this nervous energy, you know, you're thinking about it, you're praying about it, you're talking about it, and you go, what did I just do? I had a job. What am I doing? And so I said, well, Mother, you know, it seems to me that you wanted me to go in this direction. So you must know that I will be relying entirely on you in doing your work here. You've got to help me out. You've got to show me what to do. I said, why don't we start with, what do I call this thing? And the first words that entered my mind were Lepanto Institute. And I thought, well, that's interesting. I like it. I mean, I love the Battle of Lepanto and the history behind it. And, you know, the word institute sounds, you know, established. And so I thought, gosh, that's a good name. I like it. And then I got snarky with Our Lady and I said, okay, so what does the logo look like? And immediately in my head, I see a ship surrounded by a rosary with the words Lepanto Institute on either side. And I got the meaning of it too. The meaning of it was that the ship represents the naval battle of Lepanto, and the rosary surrounding it was to show that it was recourse to the rosary that brought about the victory. Oh, and by the way, at the same time, in 1571, the three things that were the three greatest threats to Christendom were heresy, Protestantism, and Islam. And those are the three same threats that we face today. And so the ship also represents the bark of Peter. Sure. The rosary, of course, is going to be what our recourse is in these latter days. As Our Lady said, her Immaculate Heart would triumph. And so that is the way that we are going to crush those three same enemies facing us now. And I was blown away. I mean, just absolutely blown away. And I got really excited. I wanted to tell my wife, but she was asleep, so I waited until the next morning. So I was the first one up, which never happens. I was up, I was making coffee, I was making breakfast, and finally she comes out, and I told her about the conversation that I had with Our Lady the night before, and she said, well, you realize that yesterday was October 7th. And I said, and? She goes, that's the Feast of Our Lady of Victory, the Feast of Our Lady of the Rosary, the Battle of Lepanto. Yeah. I had no idea. No idea. Wow. I was so focused on what I was supposed to be doing, it didn't even enter into my mind. So wow, I have no doubts that this is what Our Lady wants me to do.
Yeah, that's an absolutely tremendous story. I'm glad you shared that with us as we're laying down a foundation here with Michael Hitchborn from the Lepanto Institute. Get to his website. I'll put it in the description box. Make sure you're checking in frequently for all of his latest information. I know I've been trying to reblog it for you as of late, Michael. So if you've got new work, just send me an email. We'll get it reblogged, and we'll get all that traffic flowed back to your website. Now, talk a little bit about the Catholic media game in general. You know, some of the obstacles in getting started with this new endeavor of yours. Maybe some of the attacks from inside, a lot of resistance maybe to the information that you're presenting, not only clergymen, but then also laity. And just some of the, you know, it's not easy to expose corruption or point out errors or heresies that's going on inside the church. And I always try to reassure individuals from my end, you know, the end game is the salvation of the souls. It's not to make anyone look stupid. Yeah, sometimes we're a little sarcastic, a little witty. It's only to do that to keep from crying in reality. We're not here to cause trouble. I mean, we're really here in charity to help. And I know you're facing a lot of resistance, too. We've recently been attacked by the mainstream media, Father Longenecker, you know, and then also other traditionalist sites. So talk to us a little bit about the, you know, the obstacles and maybe some of your strategy as to how you're handling your website.
Sure. Well, you know, the thing is that the opposition comes in two forms. One, it's the obvious enemy, you know, the National Catholic Reporter or America Magazine, the obvious heretics that are going to scream and cry and just scream bloody murder because you're exposing their pet projects. And that's to be expected. You know, that just rolls right off my back. The part that hurts, though, and I have to say it always hurts when you have to expose some of the seedier aspect of what's going on in the Catholic Church. It's never easy, and I never I never go out with information without going through proper channels first, because I don't want the church to get a black eye. I don't want the church to suffer because of these exposures. But when the hierarchs of the church refuse to do anything, I have no recourse. And the fact of the matter is that in following the precepts laid out in Matthew 18, first go to your brother. If your brother doesn't listen, take him to the church. If the church doesn't listen, take it to the faithful, you know? And that's the way that I've been going about it, is trying to make sure that I go to the problem first. When that doesn't work, I go to the leadership of the church. And when that doesn't work, I go to the faithful and I tell them what's going on. So, you know, you get the opposition from the enemy, and that's to be expected. But what's really hard and what hurts the most is getting the opposition from good, faithful priests and bishops who think that all you want to do is smear the church and attack the church and make them look bad. And that's absolutely not the case. I'll give you an example.
Sure.
Last year, I started investigating the World Meeting of the Family, or World Meeting of Families, that was taking place in Philadelphia. And the only reason that I did is that somebody sent me a tip saying that the lady who was the bottleneck point, the one vetting all of the vendors at the event, was a homosexual activist. And so I did a little digging and I published a report on it. Now, I got smacked back by the Archdiocese of Philadelphia because I published without going to them first. And I publicly apologized for that. I really should have gone to them first, and I didn't. Subsequently, I also did a little bit more digging and found out that the leadership of the World Meeting of Families, the guy who was actually the head of the World Meeting of Families, was a donor to Planned Parenthood. And some of the other leadership members of the World Meeting of Families were active advocates for homosexuality, for Planned Parenthood, for abortion and contraception. And I brought this to the attention of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. I sent them all of the information. I contacted the guy who is the head of the World Meeting of Families. Nobody would respond. I called, I left messages, I sent emails. I kept telling them, this is my deadline, please just even let me. I said, I don't want to have to publish this information. And nobody would get back to me. So I even moved the deadline because I wanted to make sure that they had every opportunity to correct me if I was wrong. And they refused. And so I published. And the next thing I know, I've got a smackdown from Archbishop Chaput saying that the Lepanto Institute and Michael Hitchborn only want to cause division in the church. What else was I to do?
Yeah.
But that's where it hurts the most.
Now, do you find, it's kind of a similar question, do you find that I'll put it to you mildly, the way Francis is swaying, or the direction he's heading into, do you find that working to your advantage? I mean, I would even argue to my advantage, with more people trying to find websites like yours as opposed to the National Catholic Reporters and things of that nature. Do you find that's, I mean, is it kind of like a blessing in disguise?
Well, I think that, well, let's put it this way. The very strange things that come out of Pope Francis's mouth are causing the left to be emboldened, and so they are coming out and saying things that are absolutely ridiculous and against the church. I mean,
sure.
Since Pope Francis started talking about the homosexuals as if we have to accept them, the next thing I know, I find USCCB employees who are posting rainbow flags on their Facebook pages.
Oh, I can't stand that. You
know? Oh, it drives me nuts. In fact, the head of Catholic News Services, a guy named Tony Spence, the official voice box for the USCCB, he was emboldened by Pope Francis, and he finally started posting things on Twitter saying that, North Carolina's attempts to legislate against transsexuals going into their opposite sex bathrooms was he said that it was discrimination and it was bigotry and all this stuff, and I exposed that, and the next thing I know, 2 days later, he was fired. Wow. So every once in a while, you get a victory too. It's not, but you know, I have to say this. It's not really a matter of advantage or disadvantage. The fact of the matter is we are called to testify to the truth.
Absolutely. And
if I am doing what I'm supposed to do in putting forward what I know to be true, and I'm doing it in the most charitable, best way possible, then the results are entirely up to Our Lady and Our Lord. And if that means that I get no coverage, then I get no coverage. If that means that only a few bishops see it, but they're the ones that Our Lord and Lady want to see it, then they're the ones who will see it.
Great point.
If nobody sees it, you know, it doesn't matter, because I was given this to do. I am doing it faithfully, and the results are entirely up to God.
Great point. Great point. I know we want to transition into three more main areas that you would like to discuss today. So let's just jump right into that. I still have other topics I'd like to get into, but you know, you first wanted to talk about a recent article that you published regarding a joint letter between the CRS, the USCCB, sent to Congress asking them to fund two contraception-pushing agencies called PEPFAR and USAID. Why don't you walk us through this piece and what you found in this investigation, your research?
Sure. So back in February, the USCCB and Catholic Relief Services sent a joint letter to Congress. And the letter basically said, look, you know, we like making sure that programs that help the poor are funded. We want to make sure that programs that help the poor are funded. And so they were basically saying, we want you to follow this funding schedule that we are suggesting to you, so that certain programs get certain amount of funds. In that funding schedule, and the document has USCCB's logo on it and CRS's logo on it, and it even has a box that says USCCB and CRS request for how much they're asking Congress to give these organizations. It said they want USAID's HIV/AIDS programs to get $330 million and PEPFAR's HIV/AIDS programs to get $5.67 billion. So they're not asking for a small amount of money for these two agencies. And what I pointed out in my initial report, which I published in, I think I published this in May. What I published in the initial report was, look, USAID and PEPFAR are neck deep in contraception and condoms. That's primarily what they do. I mean, it's no secret that USAID is out there pushing contraception in almost every single aspect of what it does. And PEPFAR, you know, it's all about fighting HIV and AIDS, but its primary means of doing that is through condoms. Even though CRS, they've carved out a little niche for themselves by saying, well, we have this exemption clause that says that we can do PEPFAR programs without having to do the contraception stuff. They allegedly have that same kind of clause with USAID. I'll believe it when I see it. But the fact of the matter is that even if they have that little caveat where CRS doesn't have to participate in the contraception and condom promoting programs, they're asking us, Catholics, we the people of the United States, to fund two agencies that are strongly pushing contraception. I mean, talk about shooting yourself in the foot and undermining the teachings of the church. Why would you ask Congress to fund two agencies that are actually working against the church's moral teachings on sexuality? Why would you do that? Go ahead.
Now, I was just going to ask you a follow-up question. You think that's nefarious or is just ignorance?
I think they're basically lobbying for their own paychecks.
Unbelievable.
You know, because two-thirds of what CRS gets annually, I mean, CRS is almost an $800 million a year organization. And two-thirds of that money is coming from either USAID or PEPFAR.
Wow.
So they're effectively lobbying for their own paychecks, which is why they wrote that letter. So then, and this is where it got interesting, A couple of my readers wound up contacting the USCCB. One wrote a letter to Archbishop Kurtz, and the other wrote to just the USCCB's general inbox, email inbox. And they wound up getting a very interesting set of excuses coming from the USCCB, basically outlining, well, we have this exemption. We don't have to participate in the contraception programs. But that's not what you asked Congress to do. You asked Congress to fund these two agencies regardless of whether they're promoting contraception or not.
Yeah.
Their rhetoric that came out of the USCCB, I'll say this. I can't get into the guy's disposition. I can't say how intentional it was.
Sure.
But the rhetoric was very dodgy, and he absolutely, adamantly refused to address the problems of USAID.
Yeah, I was just about to sound. It sounds like he's tap dancing her a little bit. And what was the overall? Was there a lot of backlash with this story? I mean, not just with the individuals you're directly working with, but how did the people who follow your work? How did the general mainstream, mainstream church news outlets take this story?
Well, you know, this particular story didn't get a whole lot of coverage, which is a little surprising. But the fact of the matter is that there are a lot of Catholics now who are very upset with the way that the USCCB is handling funds. And I would dare to say that I think that there are a lot of Catholics who are now ready to say we're done supporting any of the bishops' annual collections if they're going to be funding the USCCB. And I have a hard time faulting them for that.
Yeah, I agree with you. Unbelievable story. I mean, I'm glad that you're doing this work, Michael. I mean, this is important for us to know. And again, you have my commitment that I'll continually keep this information moving. You definitely need the support in this area. Now, where should we go from here? Did you have any other points you would like to add with this particular piece, or did you want to move on to the second story, which involves the CRS and direct money being funneled to organizations to perform sterilizations, dispense contraception, and also directly to commit abortions, which is just absolutely egregious.
Sure, let's move on to that because the story about what's going on with the two letters kind of funnels into this. It's
sure.
CRS is lobbying Congress to give money to these two horrible agencies. I mean, they might as well be asking Congress to fund Planned Parenthood when it was called the American Birth Control League before it was performing abortions, because that's exactly what USAID does. But, you know, as I said, CRS is effectively lobbying for its own paycheck. And so when you look at the kinds of organizations that CRS is partnering with, I can tell you, I've already done the research on the organizations that CRS has funded for the last 6 years, and between 85 to 92% of all the organizations they partner with annually and funnel government money to, it shows up on their 990s as a grant, between 86 and 92% of those organizations are themselves dispensing contraception, performing abortions, performing sterilizations. You know, they are doing these horrible, terrible things. And the real irony, and this is where I just have to shake my head, the real irony is that even the Catholic Campaign for Human Development has a rule, a stated rule, that they won't give any money to organizations that push contraception or abortion or homosexuality. But CRS adamantly refuses to implement a rule like that, saying, well, that's how development works.
Yeah, according to them, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, come on. Are you kidding me? So, as I said, I've done a lot of research. I've still got a lot of reporting to do on the organizations that CRS has been funneling money to. But, you know, they gave $564,000 to an organization called Child Fund. And one of the things about Child Fund is that it's going around distributing misoprostol, which is the abortion pill,
yeah.
And it's injecting they're implementing the injectable contraception. This other organization, D-Tree International, was actually created by a guy who his sole purpose in creating the organization was to push contraception. So D-Tree International exists for the purpose of spreading contraception. CRS gave them $106,000. And when you look at what D3 International does, they actually came up with an iPhone app to help women get access to contraception.
Unbelievable.
And it's to be implemented in all of their development work in Africa.
This is amazing. So what you know, when you're presenting this information to a lot of the bishops, I mean, what do you get? Are you getting backlash? Are you getting heated exchanges? Are you getting just a silent treatment? Like, oh, Michael, you know, it's always going to be in the church. Just don't worry about it. I mean, what's the common response you're getting?
Well, I have to say, I have spoken to a number of bishops personally, showing them page after page of documentation that I have found regarding Catholic Relief Services. Only once in a personal face-to-face exchange did I get excuse-making and we'll just say that it was a less than amicable exchange.
Okay.
Only once. The other times, one bishop even looked at me, his jaw dropped as I was turning page after page, and he looked at me and he just shook his head and he said, "Michael, this is horrible. What should we do?" And immediately my response was, "Your Excellency, I'm coming to you because this is for you to handle. How am I supposed to tell you what to do?
Yeah.
You're the authority here." But that's unfortunately indicative of the problem that the vast majority of bishops in this country have. Number one, they're in the dark. They really don't know what's going on, I think, with regard to Catholic Relief Services. Number two, they're getting lied to by their staff. I can tell you absolutely, hands down, this is what is going on. And here's an example. Last year, my major report on Catholic Relief Services, I worked hand-in-hand with Population Research Institute. And what we discovered is that Catholic Relief Services was implementing programs in Kenya that were pushing contraception. Even the resource manuals were pushing contraception. And the reason I was able to find all of this in their documentation or in government documents, it said CRS is implementing this program, which encourages contraception. It's also implementing this program, which dispenses condoms. And so as I was looking through that material, the government document, I did the online research to find the resources to verify that, yes, that's exactly what this program does and that's what this program does. I found CRS's implementing partners all saying, yes, we are implementing this program and it talks about condoms and contraception. Even Caritas of the Diocese of Kenya said on their website, yes, we are implementing this program with Catholic Relief Services and it teaches kids about contraception and condoms. That is in black and white on their website. Okay, so then Population Research Institute went to Kenya. They interviewed people that were involved in the programs. They obtained certain manuals that were being used by this project implemented by CRS. They interviewed students who had been through these programs, and they all confirmed, yes, this program does teach kids all about contraception. So I sent this information to CRS, except for I didn't tell them that what we had found on the ground. The response I got back from CRS was, we met with PEPFAR in Kenya, and they apologized for mistakenly identifying them with this program. And they have since corrected the record. And when I went back and looked at the online documents, the government record was changed. And they deleted all references in CRS's program description to implementing these programs. Now, what CRS didn't know is that we had actually sent a FOIA request to the government to obtain all of the documentation about this program. And on CRS letterhead, it admits we implemented this program and this program and this program. And then at the very end of the program, in the very last year, it said, well, we may have found a problem with one of these programs, and we might have to not use it.
Wow.
So the government record was changed at CRS's request.
Well, I'm glad you exposed that. I mean, again, this is why this work is so important. I don't think people realize these stories, and that's kind of ties back to my previous question. People really do need to hear this, Michael. I mean, you know, I realize what you're saying about getting to a few that our lady wants to, and yes, that's certainly true. But I mean, we got to get your information moving more widespread. So again, you have my commitment to get this moving. I mean, this just makes my blood boil. I mean, this. Talk about the righteous.
Likewise.
Yeah, it just makes the righteous anger. I mean, we got to take a stand on all levels right now, even though we're just laymen. I mean, we're called to, you know, defend the church. Certainly in this respect, you know, defend the unborn. I mean, can you imagine some of the atrocities coming based upon these programs? And it kind of ties in with your last topic or main topic that you wanted to cover specifically concerning, you know, just the overall state of the church, crisis in the church. You know, that we have, I don't think anyone could really doubt at this point, been infiltrated, invaded by Marxists. I always give it the three M's, modernists, Masons, and Marxists. Masonry and Marxism kind of goes hand in hand. And I recommend two works, School of Darkness by Bella Dodd, and then also Memoirs of an Anti-Apostle. I'm not even sure who the author was. I know it was written by a nurse who got a hold of this particular writings of this Marxist, but it just goes to show you that they're in high places now, and they're swaying the church in the wrong direction. But let's cover this a little bit. I think it's an older piece of yours, but it certainly is still relevant this day, of course. We can talk a little bit about CCHD. I mean, wherever you want to go with this, Michael, you know, just sure. Kind of take it.
Well, you know, okay, so a little while ago, I was contacted by an organization out in Indiana. And they asked me to come out and give a talk. And I said, okay, sure, what do you want me to talk about? And they said, well, why don't you talk about the Marxist infiltration into the Catholic Church? I said, fine, not a problem. When do you want me to do that? They said, can you come out next week? And so I said, yeah, okay, I can do that. I said, how long do you want me to talk? They said, can you give four presentations, an hour each? I said, yeah, I could probably do that. So I spent the next 5 days from about 6 in the morning till about 1 in the morning, just researching and writing. And I wrote probably about 60 pages worth of text plus 220 slides, going through systematically what it is that we're up against. And one of the things that I did, I started with Freemasonry, actually. And I showed how Freemasonry was born out of the Enlightenment. It was born out of Enlightenment thinkers that were starting to adopt a neo-pagan kind of idealism, sure. Moving away from the church. It was actually born out of Protestantism. And I talked about what it is that Freemasonry wants to do. They want to eradicate the family. They want to eradicate property, and they want to eradicate the Catholic Church. And then in the place of those three things, they want to implement Masonic rules regarding property, Masonic rules regarding family, and Masonic rules regarding religion. So it's like they want to kill the church so they can replace it. That's what they want to do. Marxism was born straight out of Freemasonry. The lodges that popped up all over Europe after the Illuminati fell, Adam Weishaupt and his group, they were discovered. They changed their name to Jacobins. And the Jacobins were the ones who fomented the French Revolution, which is the blueprint for the Communist Revolution. Yeah. And when you look at the way that all of this kind of developed, the philosophical thought behind it all, Karl Marx's affiliations, he was affiliated with organizations who were members of secret societies, Freemasons, various socialist leagues, all throughout Europe. And so he was approached by those individuals who said, we want you to codify our political thought, our political and economic thought. So he did. He wrote the Communist Manifesto. It was at their behest. So this was born straight out of Freemasonry. And then when you look at the Communist Revolution in the early 1900s, it is the direct result of all of that thought from Marx, which all came from Freemasonry, which came from the Enlightenment, which is found at its very heart in the Protestant Revolution. And it's very interesting to me that Protestantism started in 1517. Freemasonry started in 1717, and the Communist Revolution started in 1917. So you have three very important dates surrounding the three main enemies of the Catholic Church. They're all united in this. And so when you look at it, and when you look at what happened with the Communist Revolution, of course, they were able to obtain a main base in the Soviet Union, starting with Russia and then bleeding into the satellite states around them, especially after World War II, the betrayal at Yalta. What you find is that communism does not want to be contained. It does not want to have its territory and just live there and have their own little socialist utopia and their own little area. They want to spread. They have to spread. They're not content being in their own little area. They hate the idea that anyone who is against Marxism actually exists. And so when you look at the writings of Lenin and the plans implemented by Stalin, what they did is they created certain front groups, because Lenin did it before the revolution. He created these communist front groups that were not directly connected with communism, but they were saying communist things and they were spreading communist ideas, but they were not directly connected to communists, so that the police couldn't come in and bust open their operation and stop what they were doing. So that's how the communist propaganda spread in Russia at the very beginning. Once the revolution in Russia took place and they had a hold, they didn't have a need for front groups in Russia anymore. They could just all be communist. But then Stalin, in looking outward, realized that if he was going to start taking over other areas, he needed to create front groups in other countries. And this is where the KGB came into play. And so they started creating front groups in the United States, in Canada, in South America. They created front groups in China, in Korea, all over the world. They started creating these front groups. And they would sit there and they would put out their communist propaganda and do their communist organizing thing. And what you will see, if you go to my article, The Communist Core of the Catholic Campaign for Human Development, you will see how these front groups started organizing people on the ground. They would agitate and then they would organize. They would say, there's this problem and it's caused by this person or this organization or this ideology. And they would point and point and point. And then they would create false crises and stir the people up and say, this is their fault. This happened because of them. And then they would organize them and say, we have to do something about it because the government's not going to do anything about it, or the police aren't going to do anything about it. And in fact, we are seeing this happen right now in our very own country with the Black Lives Matter movement. We can talk about that later. Sure. But the root of it is in communist agitation. That's where all of this organizing came from, yeah. From the communists. Saul Alinsky worked hand in glove with the communists. He used to fund the communist revolution as it was taking place. And from his work in funding communism and in working with communists, he thought, you know what, I should start working with the Catholic Church, because he liked working with priests. And so he started his little community organizing groups, didn't affiliate them with communists because he didn't want to spook any of the Catholic hierarchs. And he very slowly started inserting untoward things in his little community organizing. First, it started off with saying, wow, this kid got run over at this street corner because the government won't put up a street light. And we've got to organize in order to get the government to put up a street light. Well, nobody's saying that there's anything wrong with putting up a streetlight. Nobody's saying that there's anything wrong with organizing to have a streetlight put up in a dangerous intersection. Actually, that's a good thing. But this is how they work. This is how they think.
Sure.
They're always thinking about trying to find that next step that is going to get people to trust them, get people to follow their program, And then once they start branching off into these other things, they create coalitions, they work with other organizations that are a little bit untoward, but they'll say, well, we're marching together because if we can get them to support or if we help them out in this one area, they'll come back and support us in what we are trying to accomplish. And so we'll all be able to accomplish this great work. And so that's what he did. He started working with Catholics. He started working with the Catholic Church. And the next thing you know, in the 1970s, the Catholic Campaign for Human Development is born straight out of it. Monsignor Jack Egan was very good friends with Saul Alinsky. Jack Egan is the one who got Cardinal Bernardin to start the Catholic Campaign for Human Development as a national collection at the USCCB. And so through that those community organizing efforts, what do you have to do? You've got to staff these positions now, right? Because they're taking up a national collection. So we have to have a national staff. And so these social justice types were hired, brought in to be staff members. These guys are far left. A lot of times they're not even Catholic. And so they're the ones who are vetting these grants. And so you have Catholics who are complaining, why are we giving money to these organizations that are definitely communist sympathizers or these other organizations that are soft on abortion? And the church kept saying, oh, nothing's wrong. You guys are just a bunch of cranks. But they aren't cranks. They're finding out the truth. And so I started digging back in 2009, and I found, absolutely, the Catholic Campaign for Human Development is funding socialist, pro-abortion, pro-homosexual organizations, and they're ignoring all of the evidence against these groups.
Unbelievable. Yeah, as you're talking, I'm revisiting this piece that you did. Some of the key figures there, Manning Johnson. Just unbelievable that a lot of people don't know the origins of some of these organizations that have that label of Catholic. I don't know where you want to take it from there, if there was any other points you wanted to add in relation to that, Michael. I mean, there's a few other subjects I wanted to get in before. We've only got about 15 minutes here or so. I wanted to get next, if we can, into the whole sodomite agenda.
Sure.
You know, this is an area which I've been alerting and warning people about. And you know, people way before me, I mean, even Father Malachi Martin warned that the normalization of sodomy was coming, and this was a couple decades ago, that this was a part of the NWO plan. And, you know, we're seeing it here with the latest Orlando fiasco. The day after, we're seeing it all over the mainstream media. But then, as you mentioned, I saw it popping up all over, you know, like on people on Facebook who are putting, you know, the gay pride flag up. And, you know, I did a whole piece on that, how that literally ties into the Luciferian New Age. And it certainly can't be taken in the Orthodox context that you and I would understand. Certainly has nothing to do with that. And so most people don't realize that oneness that's being created right now with transgenderism, the sodomites. I mean, this is all being umbrellaed under Lucifer, essentially. So I wanted to get your take a little bit on the sodomite agenda, you know, your research, however you want to take it there. I mean, to me, I think it's quite clear. We're living in the days of Lot, and I was glad I listened to one of your talks this morning where you highlighted, too, the Akita message. The world's not going to be destroyed by the flood. It's going to be just, you know, taken out by fire. So I think we're kind of seeing the same things here, and that's one of the things we do at Tradcat Night is try to point that out. You know, pay attention to the skies. 2017 may be, as you mentioned, the 17 number, 15, 17, 17, 17, 19, 17. I don't know. 2017 seems to be like a pretty key date to me.
You know, I definitely think so, too. And we're already seeing the acceleration. You know, I can't remember which saint said it, but what he said was that all things accelerate to their end.
Yeah.
And when you look at the way things are going right now, I mean, let's face it. In the beginning of the 1900s, life was still fairly at a slow pace. Even though we had the automobile, we were just now getting airplanes, the telegraph, and you know, trains and everything else. You look at the old newsreels, and it looks like it's a fast-paced life, but things were still fairly slow for the common person. But as the century progressed, there is no doubt that we have become a hustle and bustle society, and everything is accelerating. Everything is changing so fast. I mean, who would have guessed in the year 2000 that the biggest fight of our, you know, our current culture cultural battle would be same-sex marriage or transgender bathrooms. That wasn't radar. But here we are. And it's that acceleration. Things are changing very rapidly. And I think that as we approach the 100th anniversary of Fatima, I definitely think that we'll be seeing a lot more changes. Things are going to become a lot harder. Our Lady said that the devil is going to be furious because he knows his time is short. And when you think about the kind of rumblings that we're seeing, it's almost like somebody who's panicked because they know that they don't have a whole lot of time left. And I think that the devil is panicking. I think that Our Lady is definitely coming to crush his head. She promised that she would. And I hold on to that hope. I hold on to that hope. I may not live to see it. I hope I do. But Our Lady promised that she would crush the serpent's head, that in the end her Immaculate Heart would triumph, and that I do think that the scourge of homosexuality, and it is a scourge, will come to an end. The scourge of abortion will come to an end. The poison of contraception will certainly take a back seat, probably come to an end. And it'll be for a time. It's not permanent. But, you know, whenever Our Lady has a victory, it's never a total victory because we're still here to have our souls tried by fire. We are still trying to prove ourselves to God through grace and through the sacraments. So, but, you know, to this question about the Luciferian element of the homosexual movement, it is absolutely diabolical.
Oh, yeah.
I think about what it is. You know, it's interesting because when you think about the name Michael, St. Michael, who was St. Michael? St. Michael was a guardian angel, or an archangel. He was just an archangel, which is one of the lower rung angels. He's not even in the upper echelon. And Lucifer was the highest created being at that time. And Lucifer rebelled against God, said, "I will not serve." And Michael, his name is a question. It means who is like God. And it's interesting because the question has an answer. Man is like God. Man was created in God's image and likeness. And so what is it that man can do that Lucifer can't? Why would Lucifer want to elevate himself to the heights and to make himself above God? He couldn't make himself above God, and he was intelligent enough to know that. So what was it that he was doing? He was jealous of man. He was jealous that man is like God. Man has the ability to create, to procreate. Angels can't.
Good point.
Angels can't make other angels. And so what is Lucifer going to do then? He is going to attack man in the way that he is most like God. He is going to attack man in the way that he is like God, and that is in the participation of creation.
Yeah, wasn't it Sister Lucia who said the last attack would be on marriage and family?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And so when you think about that, and you think about Michael saying, who is like God? Man is like God. And so Lucifer, in attacking man, is going to do, or trying to tempt man to do what he wants to do, to be something that he's not. Lucifer can't be a man, but he wishes he could. And men are now saying that they want to be women. And women are saying that they want to be men. The transgender thing is that twist. It is the perversion. It takes what was created by God and twists it into something that was not meant to be. And Lucifer was the first one to do it. That is what the homosexual movement is all about. It's about that perversion of nature. And so Lucifer, in making the rainbow flag the symbol of the homosexual movement, is kind of a thumbing of the nose at God, saying, "You promised. You promised. You led the world again."
Yeah. Yeah, I get tired of seeing that too on my Twitter as I'm going through. See all these people with the hashtag love wins. Again, it's Lucifer's false light. It's a perverted understanding of love. These people think, these people think that this is actually real love and that this is how God has orchestrated things when we know otherwise. It's really, I mean, it just tells you the times that we live in. When we've hit that point, We know that chastisement is not far off. Speaking of some more dangers, we'll move along a little bit more. We only got a few more minutes here. I was interested in your take, and perhaps you could relay this story again. I saw this on Church Militant TV, a little piece of yours concerning the charismatic movement. And you had one story in particular about a priest who was hearing the people muttering. And I've done a few pieces on the charismatic movement, linking it to another false Eastern movement, which is called Kundalini. And yep. It's very similar. And when you look at those people, it's obvious that they're under demonic influence. And I also point out, too, from Scripture, when you read the early church fathers' warnings, we know that the Antichrist will actually be speaking in tongues and he'll be charismatic. And so that's kind of the direction that we're moving in. And a lot of people identifying themselves as Catholics are falling into this category. Now, I can tell you I have in times past, actually a couple times, been fortunate enough to get out. But I wanted to get your takes on the danger of the charismatic movement and then maybe specifically that story.
Sure. So the charismatic movement, it actually has its roots in Protestantism. It is not a Catholic movement. It was started by a Pentecostal woman, and it was later adopted by certain individuals in the Catholic Church, and it's kind of dubious as to where exactly it got started or why it was adopted by the Church. But the fact of the matter is that it was made mainstream in the Church by the revolution that took place right after the Second Vatican Council. You had priests wearing rainbow vestments and breaking pita bread over a clay paten. You know, they absolutely demolished the nature of the Mass. You had clown masses. All of this is part and parcel to the roots of the charismatic movement. And I know that a lot of charismatic Catholics out there are going to say, oh, but you're taking the worst examples and you're applying this to something that isn't really a part of what we are and what we believe. Well, the caveat to that is, well, then tell me exactly who your leader is. Who is the leader? Who is the head of the charismatic movement who determines and decides exactly what it is that charismatic Catholics believe and profess? Because if you can't point to that, then all you have is the amorphous they. They say this or they say that. Or, well, I believe this based on my interpretation of Scripture, which is Protestant.
Sure.
And so they don't have a very specific thing that they can point to. They don't have a leader of their movement that they know of, only just that they have local prayer gatherings and somebody is usually in charge. But, you know, it was all mainstreamed into the Catholic Church by the result of the revolution that took place with the changes in the Mass. Now, I have to say the caveat is that these were not approved changes. These are things that were done in rebellion against even the changes that were done. I'm not approving of those changes. But what I am saying is that...
I understand what you're saying, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, when you look at the situation, the charismatic movement itself is very, very steeped in Gnosticism. The idea of slaying of the spirit in order to gain the gift of tongues is purely Gnostic. It's this idea that you have to undergo a certain ritual or rite in order to receive certain manifested gifts of the Holy Spirit, which is not true. We go through confirmation, and that is when you receive the gifts of the Holy Spirit. There is no other ritual or rite that is approved by the Church which allows for the gifts of the Holy Spirit to be passed on to a person. So they've diluted themselves into this way of thinking. And then, so this story, I have a friend who knows a Catholic priest, a very good, prominent Catholic priest, and I can't disclose his name, but he was studying in Rome. This priest was fluent in several languages. He was studying ancient languages in Rome. And he had heard about a charismatic mass that was taking place in a particular church in Rome. And so he decided that he would go see what this was all about. And he was standing in the back, and he heard muttering coming from different people in the congregation. He approached the person who was closest to him afterward, and he said, I heard you muttering in mass. He said, what was that all about? And she said, well, I have the gift of tongues. He said, you have the gift of tongues. Do you know what you were saying? She said, well, no, I don't have the interpretation of tongues. I only have the gift of speaking in tongues. He said, let me tell you what you were saying. You were blaspheming God in three different languages, Greek, Latin, and Aramaic.
That's just
like... And Well, it's diabolical. The devil exists, and he will find openings wherever he can.
Oh, yeah.
You know, this is what, why does St. Paul say, put on the armor of God? Put it on so that he can't find those little chinks in the armor and those little rust spots. That's why we go to confession, so that we can be fully armored. Wear your scapular. I have to say that I have felt far fewer temptations and attacks since I started wearing my scapular on a regular basis. I started wearing my scapular regularly about 10 years ago, and it has been probably the best thing that I ever did.
Yeah, I because agree. Yeah.
It is my armor. I never take it off.
Yeah, I can testify to that. Many know my story, my immoral past. First day I put the scapular on, I actually have a rosary on me at all times, usually around my neck. That's my weapon. I got my armor on, and I will agree, it's not going to eliminate temptation completely, but yeah, I mean, it has been an unbelievable night and day difference between the days previous to my conversion until after. And I'll allow you to continue. I wanted to add one more point to the charismatic movement, and then we'll move into one more topic, and then we'll close out.
Sure.
The point that I wanted to make with the charismatic movement, too, is very dangerous, too. And I found this because I graduated, Michael. I'm not sure if you know this. I actually graduated from Franciscan University, which is probably the most known charismatic university out there. I did my undergrad and grad school there. And listen, I know a lot of those priests still, some of which are still charismatic. Some of my neighbors are still. One of my neighbors is actually Scott Hahn. He literally lives right down the road from me. And there's some other professors, by the way, too, who are waking up to what we're saying in terms of the crisis, too. I don't want to mention any names, but they will basically re-echo what we're saying, but they won't say it publicly, to put it mildly. I would just argue that, it ties in with this whole experience thing, and it places experience above doctrine, sort of tying in with modernism, to where, you know, you could have someone identifying themselves as a Catholic, another person as a Protestant, yet they get together or talking in tongues and they think everything's A-okay, and yet the Protestant has terrible doctrine. Well, we know you're not going to save your soul, objectively speaking, without proper doctrine. And so that's there's kind of like a commonality there, I guess, is what I'm saying. And it ties in with the modern ecumenism as well. So I wanted to add that. But in closing, Michael, what stands out amidst all your work over the years? What's that one story that stands out, you know, shoulders above the rest, that has just tipped you off completely? I mean, that's just, you know, the one story that maybe comes to mind over and over again that you have presented to the public.
Wow. the one story that just really stands out, you know, there are so many things that I've researched and so many things I've written about, it's really hard to point to any particular one. But I do have an anecdote that I think is kind of amusing that I'll share. So I've been researching CCHD grantees, and I was finding all sorts of things that were going on. And John Carr used to be the head of peace and justice at the USCCB, and I'd met with him on a number of occasions, and he did not like me at all because I always called his bluff. And one year I had presented to him information on this one group. And what I showed him was that this organization had joined a coalition that was promoting same-sex marriage in Maryland. And I said, look, here is the organization. Here's where they signed up. Here's their Twitter feed or their Facebook page saying that they've signed up with this thing. So what's going on? His response to me was, well, it turns out that some lower level employee decided to take it upon themselves to sign them up. And it was all a mistake. It was it wasn't something that they as an organization intended to do. I let it go. I thought, okay, you know what? I can't prove or disprove this except to say that this is the evidence that I've got, but this is a lame excuse. So the next year, that same organization was up for another grant, and I looked them up again, and I did a little bit more digging. I thought, you know what? If they're going to sign up for a coalition, there's got to be some evidence that says that they intended to do this. I found their meeting minutes, and I found the meeting minutes that says, hey, why don't we sign up and help the same-sex marriage movement in Maryland, right there in the meeting minutes. and went back to John Carr and I said, "Hey, John, remember when you told me that it was all a mistake, that some lower level employee done that? You told me some lower level employee had done this." And he immediately waved his hand and said, "No, no, it was. I said that maybe that's what happened." "Oh, okay, John, sure." But you know, that is the same kind of runaround that I have gotten on so many occasions with regard to CCHD or CRS or any of these other Catholic groups that are out there that are doing just horrible, terrible things. For crying out loud, Caritas Internationalis is on the governing body of an international Marxist organization called the World Social Forum.
Yeah, I saw that. You did that piece not too long ago. I remember reading that.
Yep. And I showed that information to John Carr, and he started saying things like, "Oh no, these people, they're not going to the social forum because they want to promote communism. They're doing it because they're these poor mine workers who have never been on an airplane before." And I was like, "What are you talking about?"
Yeah, just we got to keep praying, folks. That's the bottom line. We got to keep offering up our reparations to the Sacred Heart through the Immaculate Heart. Got to keep praying that rosary. You know, the end game is salvation of souls. And again, no one should misconstrue Michael's work, nor my work. Again, sometimes we have to get a little witty, a little sarcastic. It's only to keep us from crying. But the bottom line is you know, we're living, from my perspective, in a time period where it's becoming so dark that light is going to be even more, I don't even know how to say it, just more bright in the world. And there's going to be a lot of opportunities up ahead for us to, you know, relay ourselves as true Catholics to the world. And so I'm going to leave it with Michael for the last few minutes, maybe talk to the Americans, reassure them, encourage them. We didn't get into this today, but I'll definitely bring Michael back on the next few months, and we can maybe talk about the West and America specifically and kind of the direction we're going. We seem to be getting more liberal. Russia seems to be getting more conservative. And then we can talk about, you know, the Constitution, religious liberties, things along that line, and also his recent work. So I'll let you close it out with a few words. Again, get to his website, lepantoinstitute.org. All of this will be in the description box. And until next time, ladies and gentlemen, I'll sign off after this, but I want to give Michael the last few words here.
Sure. You know, the thing is, the church is facing crisis, but the church has been facing crisis ever since our Lord was crucified. And the fact of the matter is, our whole entire existence, our whole church started with a defeat. But the defeat was intended to right the wrong committed by our first parents. And we, as Catholics, can join our Lord suffering on the cross to combat the evils that are taking place, because our Lord, ultimately, what he desires the most is mercy, and he desires for us to participate in that work of mercy by offering ourselves, by offering our own bodies to stand in the gap as a sacrifice so that souls may be saved. We who are standing in the gaps right now and enduring this horrible persecution in the church, we're enduring a horrible persecution outside the church. We have a pope who is incredibly confusing and difficult, and the fact of the matter is that we have a wonderful opportunity to find salvation for ourselves and others if we're just willing to suffer and pray the rosary daily. That's exactly what Our Lady wants us to do. That's what our Lord wants us to do. And, you know, God willing, that's what I will continue to do.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. I re-echo the same sentiments in my work. In the end, the triumph of the Immaculate Heart will happen. So as we say here, spread your wings as an eagle in faith and hope, because that's what's going to take us through these times. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, stay safe and God bless.